The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. And today I'm going to revisit the only interview I ever did with Calvin Trillin. Calvin has had a long association with the New Yorker magazine. He's been writing for them since 1963. He's now in his 80s, and he hasn't slowed down. He's still around, still doing it, and he's one of many New Yorker writers that we've had on the program over the years. And when he came through Dayton on book tour back in 2003, I knew I had to interview him because you don't get too many opportunities to interview someone like him. And as it turns out, that was the only interview I've ever done with Calvin Trillin. He loves food. He loves writing about food. He writes about a lot of things, including politics. He's written some wacky poetry over the years. In fact, last year he got into a bit of a controversy over a poem he wrote about Chinese food. But we won't get into that. We're going to revisit my interview recorded back in 2003 with Calvin Trillin. It's called Feeding a Yen on the Best of the Book Nook. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Calvin Trillin. His new book is called Feeding a Yen, and he's just confessed he's never been here before. Why'd you wait so long?
It's one of the places I miss Steubenville, too, somewhere. I don't know. I really have not given Ohio the time it deserves.
We were chatting for a few moments before we went on the air, and I almost forgot to begin the program because I was getting so engrossed in our conversation, and there were so many avenues that we could travel down. Give our listeners some sense of who you are and what you've been doing all these years.
Well, I'm from Kansas City, and I've never overlooked Kansas City. But I've been with the New Yorker for 40 years, and spent most of my time reporting of one sort or another. And about 20 years or so, wrote a column for one person, for The Nation for a while, and newspaper syndication, and for Time magazine for a while. And I still write a weekly verse for The Nation. I'm a deadline poet, maybe the only deadline poet around. It's very difficult. I mean, when you think about Wordsworth and those guys, they didn't have to worry about deadlines, right? But I have to worry about deadlines, and also I have to, since my poetry is on the news, I have to worry about politicians whose names don't scan well, like Governor Pataki or even Bill Clinton, which is a difficult name, or George Bush, which has very few rhymes.
Hmm.
I was for Ross Perot, the only iambic candidate. I wanted him to win something. I didn't care much what it was. I've written a lot of different kinds of books. I think my publisher says I'm remarkably diverse, and the other way to put that is I've never quite gotten my act together, so I've never known exactly what I'm supposed to be concentrating on. And some of the books are a collection of columns, and some of them are about things like murders, and there are a few novels. The last book was a book called Tepper Isn't Going Out, which was, I believe, and I didn't come to Ohio to boast, but I believe may be the first parking novel. We don't know about other parking novels. And the book.
What do you mean by a parking novel?
A novel about a guy parking a car.
Okay.
I mean a real parking novel. It's no code or anything. Parking. Right. I am the former co-editor of a publication called Beautiful Spot, a magazine of parking. but which some people refer to as a one-issue publication, which came out in 1964 or something. We prefer to say the second issue hasn't come out yet. We've had some production difficulties, Vic, but we're working on that. And the book that we're here to discuss today, I guess, is called Feeding a Yen, and it's a book about eating. I started writing about eating, maybe 30 years ago when I was doing a series of pieces around the country for The New Yorker and someplace every 3 weeks, and I was often desperate to find someplace decent to eat that wasn't the restaurant that the Booster always recommended, which was a very fancy restaurant that I began calling generically La Maison de la Casa House Continental Cuisine. And I was always looking for what I used to describe as the local specialty or the cooking of ethnic groups strong enough to have at least two aldermen. And so I wrote about eating as a sort of a comic relief. I don't write serious things about eating in that series. And I did three books on eating, which were put together at the end in what we call the Tummy Trilogy. And then I quit writing about eating for 15 or 20 years or so. And I, last few years, I've done more of it. And this is a book really about things that I've loved somewhere. Say a type of pepper in northern Spain, or boudin in the Cajun part of Louisiana, or fish tacos in San Diego, and for some reason these things don't seem to get out of their place of origin, and so it's partly about my what I call my register of deprivation and frustration, which I go over. I compare it to a miser going over a list of people who owe him money, both tormenting and tantalizing himself. And sometimes, on good days, I call my travel agent and go back, and that's sort of what the book is about.
How many entries are currently on the register?
I would say it changes from day to day, but there are usually dozens on there. Mm-hmm. And things get taken off sometime when I say, well, I don't really miss that. I could probably do without that one. But then something else comes along. And in this book, for instance, sometimes I go looking for one thing. Like there's a chapter about going back to Nice to eat pan bagnat. Pan bagnat is, there's complicated ways to explain it, but I think if you had to explain it very simply, you'd say a tuna fish sandwich, a particularly good tuna fish sandwich, and found something called soca, which I realize I liked even better than pan bagnat, which is, of course, impossible to get outside of Nice. So that put one more thing on the list.
You live in Greenwich Village, and I'm guessing you've probably been there for a while. Do you consider yourself a New Yorker? And how do you keep a memory for those little stands that have particular foods that you're looking for?
I've been in the Village for a long time. I've been in New York for, I guess, more than 40 years. And I think of Greenwich Village as a neighborhood where people come from the suburbs on Saturday night to test their car alarms. but then there's some of us who live there all week long. And I think of myself, Vic, as a resident out-of-towner. And I've been resident for a long time, but there's certain things I'll never know, particularly about, say, the subway system. The subway system in New York is designed to keep out-of-towners in their place.
It works very well, too.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the subway system is now excellent. I mean, you can get around very well on it, but it's not simple. Give you an example. Until about, I would say, 15 years ago, it was the only subway system in the world that had all of its maps inside the subway cars. So you had to get on the train and read the map there, assuming you could get to the map, and assuming you were a graduate of the Royal School of Cartography and could actually make out the map, to find out you were on the wrong train and you were hurtling in the direction of Queens Plaza, which almost all of them seem to go to if you're lost. So it's sort of like learning French as an adult, or maybe these days I shouldn't say French, learning Bulgarian, okay, to use some of our newer friends, learning Bulgarian as an adult, there's certain words you're never going to learn. Uh-huh. Because they just sort of come with growing up. So I still consider myself a bit of an out-of-towner.
You describe one of the most futile things that I think anyone could experience, whether they live in Manhattan or are visiting. That's trying to get a cab. And sometimes it's just really a tough thing. And at one point, you're fantasizing about a particular kind of food. Was it ceviche?
Yeah, what happened was... I usually take a they now have these car services in New York. They all have Israeli names, Tel Aviv and Masada, and I assume that one of them split off from the other one. They're probably a bunch of warring cousins. I don't know. But and they're roughly the same or sometimes even less than a cab. So I usually take those to the airport. But I had to be in Midtown, and it just seemed complicated to have one pick me up there. And I left plenty of time. But it was a really hot day. It's usually fairly easy to get a cab in New York compared to, say, Washington or something. I mean, there are cities where getting a cab is really awful. But at certain times, it's hard. Uh-huh. When it's raining, it's difficult. At 4 o'clock, when the shifts change, it's almost impossible. And this just happened to be a bad day, and I was standing on Fifth Avenue. It was about 100. And I was going to on a story, so I had my computer and my bag, and it was hot. And I was just thinking some thoughts about New York that I think that the Convention and Visitors Bureau probably wouldn't appreciate my airing here. And about the cab system and everything. And this car stopped, and it was one of those town cars, a fancy car service, not the sort I take. Uh-huh. And the guy put his window down. A wonderful blast of air conditioning came out at me, and he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "LaGuardia." And he said, $25. And I said, "Done." I got in the back. And it turned out he was from Ecuador. And by this time, we were sort of found that out. We were on the Grand Central Parkway. And I said, "God, I was just in Ecuador, and I love Ecuador. I love that. It's a gorgeous country. And I love that ceviche." And he said, you really like that ceviche?" And I said, "Well, I would kill for that ceviche." And he said, "When's your plane?" And I said, "Oh, I got time." And boom, he's off the Grand Central Parkway and in some neighborhood in Queens that has Spanish signs and Korean signs and various signs like that. I mean, Queens is now sort of the United Nations. It used to be so Irish that people talked about they didn't have neighborhoods, they had parishes. They'd say, I used to interview old guys out there, and he'd say, "Oh, yeah, he was from out at St. Timothy's Parish," or uh-huh. something, even if the guy was Jewish. I mean, right. We talked about he was from St. Timothy. And we pull up in a place called Islas Galapagos restaurant, get out of the cab, in the town car, and we each had a bowl of ceviche, and I had an Ecuadorian beer. And we cleaned our plates, got back in the town car, went to LaGuardia, and I got out. The guy's name was Jose, I remember. I said, "This is a great city, Jose. A little hot sometime, but a great city."
You like to entertain the fantasy with this list of yours that you have to go somewhere to get this stuff and that you can't get it in New York. And this guy kind of threw you a curveball there by immediately taking you somewhere that had a fairly good example of
the dish. That's right. And in fact, now, particularly in Queens, because a lot of the immigrants, as you may know, the real change, aside from the various things about California cuisine and the new American cuisine and everything, the big change in American eating, I think, came with the 1965 immigration. And before the 1965 Immigration Act, immigration was on a national quota system that was based on the idea that people who ate bland food made better citizens than other people. So Great Britain and Northern Europe had by far the highest quotas, and we never actually filled the English quota. They actually were letting in more, they were willing to let in more Englishmen than wanted to come, and they totally ban Chinese. So in culinary terms, this is suicidal.
Uh-huh.
And the 65 Act, which is what I think some food people think of as their very own Emancipation Proclamation, changed all that. So it really is, and a lot of the people who came instead of all those Englishmen went to Queens or Brooklyn, mostly mm-hmm. Queens. So now, if you want an Albanian burek, if you happen to miss an Albanian burek, or if you want some Uzbeki lagman soup, which I often do want Uzbeki lagman soup, you can just go to Queens or increasingly go. I mean, there's a nice place on 47th Street that has pretty good lagman, I have to say. And I now live in a city where you can compare lagman. I mean, you can say that guy's pretty good. On the other hand, that Azerbaijani restaurant's better than that. I mean, so we have a lot of that. And it's true all over the country because the immigration is by airplane now instead of by boat. And so I was just in St. Louis and ate in a Bosnian restaurant. People in St. Louis claim they have more Bosnians in St. Louis than in any other place outside of Bosnia.
Hmm.
I mean, I don't see a lot of people standing in line bragging about, well, I got more Bosnians than you have. I mean, I don't mean that when they say they claim that other people, that Cleveland's saying, no, we got the Bosnians. That's really made eating a lot more interesting, I think.
You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today I am revisiting an interview we pulled out of the archives, recorded back in 2003. The New Yorker writer Calvin Trillin had come through Dayton on book tour for his book Feeding a Yen, and he came out to see us here in Yellow Springs. And as it turns out, this is the only opportunity I've ever had to interview Calvin Trillin. And he's an amazing guy. He has this dry wit and humor. And he is notorious for his quick poems that he's written over the years. And I want to give you an example of one he wrote about politics. He likes writing poems about politics. And this is one that he wrote back when we had a presidential candidate named Ross Perot. And listening to this poem, you might think it's dated, but it actually kind of sounds current. Here it is, The Ross Perot Guide to Answering Embarrassing Questions. When something in my history is found which contradicts the views that I propound, or shows that I am surely hardly who I claim to be, here's what I usually do. I lie. I simply, baldly falsify. I look the fellow in the eye and cross my heart and hope to die and lie. I don't apologize. Not me. Instead, I say I never said the things I said, nor did the things that people saw me do. Confronted with some things they know are true, I lie. I offer them no alibi, nor say, you oversimplify. I just deny, deny, deny. I lie. I hate the weasel words some slickies use to blur their pasts or muddy up their views. Not me, I'm blunt. One thing that makes me great is that I'll never dodge nor obfuscate. I'll lie. That was Calvin Trillin. Going back for that one, The Ross Perot Guide to Answering Embarrassing Questions. I'll continue my 2003 interview with Calvin Trillin right after this.
You're listening to the Book Nook. My guest is Calvin Trillin. The book is Feeding a Yen, and I have too many favorite chapters, but I'm going to try to at least touch on some of them. One in particular was the one where you're talking about the website chowhound.com and what that's all about. And you have this fella that keeps all these listings of all these different restaurants. I think he had over 1,000 of them just on these sheets of paper. And you were going around with them, and you talk about this sort of snobbery that takes place with people discovering restaurants and who discovered it, and
right.
You discovered this little sandwich that you were turning people on to. I love that.
Right. That was the the alpha dog of chowhound.com, as he calls himself occasionally, and another one of these people who write about the ethnic food in New York was talking about if the alpha dog discovers a restaurant and you go there and you say, well, I don't know, you know, it seemed okay, but nothing special. And he said, but you went on a Tuesday? You know that grandma's off on a Tuesday, and that she's the real cook, the real cook went back to Honduras for Christmas. I thought you knew that. I thought everybody knew that. So there's constant one-upmanship about discovery. Who's discovered what?
When we think about Paris, I think most of us think about really good food. So, being who you are, Calvin, you go to Paris to eat Chinese food.
I did have a wonderful Chinese meal in Paris, I have to tell you. And, of course, people where I grew up in Kansas City, when people think about Paris, I think they think of in the summer, it's one of the places where there aren't any chiggers because chiggers are a terrible problem in Kansas City, in that area, particularly in the tall grass. And, you know, when I go home, people say, why do you live in New York? And I say, there are no chiggers in New York. And they say, not even in the tall grass? I say, there isn't any tall grass in New York. But so sometimes when I'm in Paris, if you're on the top of the Eiffel Tower and you're next to somebody from, say, Joplin, Missouri or something, and he's looking out and you're thinking that he probably is thinking, God, the City of Lights, what a grand sight. And what he's really thinking is, even if they got him over here, they probably couldn't get up this high. I mean, he's just thinking of chiggers. And that's what I think of usually when I'm in France in the summertime. But somebody had written me about this wonderful Chinese restaurant. And also, the person who wrote me, he described his wife, who was of Chinese descent but grew up partly in Hong Kong and partly in San Francisco, as a journalist and part-time counter-revolutionary. She was very big with this crowd at Tiananmen Square and everything, and that's really what she was, a counter-revolutionary. And she could read the wall signs in Chinese restaurants. And it's very frustrating for me in New York Chinatown not to be able to read the signs on the wall.
Well, it makes you paranoid, doesn't it?
Because you know that somebody's getting something you're not getting. And I used to carry a little card around with me that said in Chinese, could you please bring me what the people at the next table are having? Because the other problem in Chinatown is a lot of times the waiters don't really speak English. And I actually knew a food writer in San Francisco and a wine writer mainly named Finnegan who went to Japan and took the trouble to learn enough Japanese to get around a little bit and was in a restaurant. Something that the man at the next table was having looked absolutely delightful. So he called the waiter over, Finnegan did, and said in Japanese, could you bring me some of what the man at the next table is eating. The waiter looked puzzled for a minute and then shrugged and went over and had a word with the man, picked up his plate and brought it over to Finnegan. So in Japan, you have to be careful with stuff like that. But anyway, this woman, Nancy Lee is her name, was wonderful at reading wall signs, although the direct translation of wall signs it really is not like the sort of stuff you read on the menu that has things like, tree shape, something, or, you know, really kind of lotus leaf, like kind of beautiful language. I mean, I think the first one she read was salty intestines.
Yeah. My guest is Calvin Trill, and the book is Feeding a Yen. I loved your chapter where you go to northern New Mexico.
That's a nice part of the country, northern New Mexico. And I had spent some time out there, quite a bit of time over the years, and I love the food. It's a kind of a special New Mexican food as opposed to Mexican food or Tex-Mex food or Cal-Mex food is quite special. But, and the thing I particularly love is pozole, which is a sort of stew made out of, it's a relative of hominy. And both in Santa Fe and north of Santa Fe, and of course, you can't get that in New York, although you can get in New York now that American food is also fashionable, you can get the food of states or sometimes counties, I think, in New York, or maybe small neighborhoods, but for some reason they've sort of skipped New Mexican food, and I like it. And I like Santa Fe, although I mention in there's a wonderful theory about Santa Fe, the dumbest sons theory, which is the sort of theory I love about American cities because it really explains everything. And according to the dumbest son theory, and I don't know enough about Santa Fe to know whether this is true or not, but that earlier in the century, partly because it was sort of exotic, and the only other really exotic place was New Orleans, which was very to live in the summer then, a lot of rich families in the East, sort of industrialist families, sent their dumbest son to Santa Fe. I mean, the guy they wanted to keep away from the business, the sort of coupon clipper, and that almost everything about Santa Fe, both in its social structure and its gene pool and everything, can be explained by the dumbest sons. But fortunately, they're not the ones who do the cooking.
As I said, I have so many favorite chapters, and I also had some preconceptions when I began your book. I automatically assumed, after reading it for a while, that you would be a great big guy because you're always eating right. In this book, but you're not. You're not at all. And then another thing I assumed but found out reading the book, I assumed you would probably be a wine snob, but you're not at all. In fact, you say some really funny things about wine, and you prefer drinking beer with your food.
I'm afraid I'm what I described in the book as I tried to be delicate with myself as a beer swilling ignoramus, and I summed up my approach to wine. Although I admitted in the book that I buy wine partly by the picture on the label,
right.
And I like a nice mountain, Vic. I like one preferably in the middle distance, and there's a chapter of the book that's where I basically talk about whether or not people can tell red from white in room temperature black glass situation, and I talk about that I have had some experience with wine people, and I was even at the barrel tasting at the Four Seasons in New York once, which is considered a very hot ticket in the wine trade.
You don't remember leaving though, do you?
I don't remember anything, but. Leaving, coming, anything. I do remember this. I do remember that they put a lot of wine in front of me, and my mother told me it's impolite to leave things when you're a guest. And so I just drank it, and I didn't really notice that the other people were sipping it. And what the guy was describing the wine of the had his mouth very close to the microphone. He was sort of droning on. It reminded me of some time I spent at the Louisiana State Legislature once. There's kind of there are various stories about how the evening ended, but they do not vary in the question of whether or not I fell asleep at the table. There's pretty much no question about that. So I would say that considering that experience that if people who knew me were asked to describe my attitude toward wine and my knowledge of wine, they would say ignorance tempered slightly by Philistinism.
My guess is Calvin Trillin. I would love to take that test. I'm not a wine snob, but I think unless they really tried to fool me with some of these wines that you talk about right. where it's really hard to tell, I think I would do okay, but I'd sure enjoy taking the test. You just mentioned Louisiana, and you have an experience in Louisiana with these, would you call them a sausage?
Well, it's sort of a sausage or a pudding or something. It's in a sausage casing, definitely. It's what the Cajuns, who, as you know, live about 2 hours west of New Orleans, call boudin. The French have something called boudin, which is a blood sausage, but this is not that. This is a sort of a pudding made out of rice and pork and liver, and probably some parts of the pig that we just as soon not find out about. We don't know where he'd get all that stuff, and it's inside of a casing, and you eat it by squeezing it. Some people just actually eat the whole casing, but not very many, I think. Most people eat it by squeezing it into your mouth from the casing, preferably leaning up against a pickup truck. It tastes a little better if you're leaning up against a pickup truck, and you usually get it either a convenience store where there's somebody there who happens to make it, or a butcher shop or a little grocery store by the side of the road that often will have a hand-drawn sign in the window saying hot boudin today. Mm. And they give it to you hot, and you go out in the parking lot. And I think I estimate in the book, using my usual scientific controls, that about 80% of it's eaten in the parking lot, and the other 20% is finished off in the car. Uh-huh. So it's an extreme example of the problem I face about local specialties. It not only doesn't get out of the state, most of it doesn't even get home. A lot of people eat it in the car, and there are even some bumper stickers down there that say, "Caution, driver eating boudin," and that's so if he flips the casing out of the window and it comes back and smashes onto your window like a kind of a foul insect, you'll know what it is.
You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and today replaying an interview I recorded 14 years ago with Calvin Trillin. He's been a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine since 1963. He's also written many, many things that have appeared in The Nation magazine. Perhaps you've seen his work in there. He began writing for them back in 1978 with a column called Variations. He also did a column called Uncivil Liberties. And he once jokingly talked about his association with The Nation magazine. And he said they pay him in the high two figures. We'll continue with the Best of the Book Nook right after this. My guest is Calvin Trillin. The book is Feeding a Yen. You're from Kansas City. When we think about Kansas City, we think about barbecue and talking about transferring flavors. You have a little anecdote in there about this guy changing the flavor of the barbecue by touching it. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, you mean, we used to think that a lot of the flavor of Arthur Bryan's barbecue came from Richie the counterman, who always pulled a plate over with his left hand and the ribs over with his right hand. And in fact, there were a very distinguished couple, John and Karen Hess, who wrote a book about eating in America, knew a lot about food, and wrote that they didn't particularly like the barbecue at Bryan's, and I couldn't understand what was the problem. And then I realized they were so distinguished looking that when Richie saw them come in, he reached down under the counter for some tongs that he kept there and had last used during a visit by the Emperor Haile Selassie in about 1937. And they didn't realize, of course, that about 40% of the taste was in Richie's right hand. That's true.
I have fond memories of going to Arthur Bryan's. We used to go down to Kansas City from Des Moines, and that was sort of a later in the evening after the ball game destination.
Right.
It
used to be before Kansas City built the new stadium. It used to be quite close to the ballpark.
Uh-huh.
And
I can remember when Rocky Colavito played down there for the Athletics.
Well, I go back to the Kansas City Blues.
Oh.
I mean, my loyalty to the Kansas City Blues was of such purity that when they left, I pretty much lost interest in baseball. I didn't care about it anymore.
My guest is Calvin Trillin. When you arrived today, one of the first questions that I asked you was, have you eaten? Where did you eat lunch? Would you like to share that with our listeners? They probably get a kick out of it.
Yeah, I would. I ate lunch at a sort of hamburger wagon in Miamisburg. It was good. There weren't a lot of hamburger wagons. I mean, you didn't have your choice. But it was it was interesting.
And how did you end up there, being a stranger in town and all?
Oh, I just sort of thought, where shall I eat in Dayton? And then I thought, Miamisburg. I bet they got some kind of hamburgers over there. No, I was taken by somebody from the paper.
Okay. From the Dayton Daily News?
Yeah, from the Dayton Daily News, yeah.
Kind of showing you the way.
Well, I said I want the real haute cuisine. Mm-hmm. I want the top place. I want if you have what do we call French restaurants now? You know, cheese eating surrender monkey restaurants. Fine, something like that, or maybe even so that's where we ended up.
You've also got a story in this book about bagels. And a bagel that really wasn't a bagel, and ways that you've tried to entice your daughters back to New York.
Yeah, I've used bagels as an attempt to get them back. I at one point, both of them were living in California, and the one in Southern California was a particularly strong bagel eater. She's the one who, when she was a little girl, wouldn't go to Chinatown unless she was carrying a bagel, just in case, she always said. And so I used to take her New York bagels, and then I decided that it was sort of counterproductive if I wanted her to move home. And so I told her if someone chooses to live in California, thousands of miles from her own family, you ought to eat California bagels. And then I understand if you buy a dozen granola bagels out there, you get two wheat germ bagels free, or maybe your choice of a wheat germ bagel and a soy waste bagel or something like that. And the other one I sent when there was, lives in San Francisco, there was an article in the Times once about a lot of people her age leaving San Francisco after the .com collapse. And the subhead said many .comers leaving in wake of .com collapse, and I added my own subhead, which I pasted on, which she's a lawyer, and so is her husband, saying many lawyers citing inferior bagels also leaving. She was back in New York once, and we were walking home from Chinatown, and I said, well, let me get this straight. If I found again that gnarly black bagel we used to get at Tannenbaum's on Sunday, you would move back to the city, right? And she said, absolutely. So I spent a lot of time looking for that bagel. And
it was pumpernickel,
right.
Wasn't it?
It was pumpernickel.
Okay. Yeah.
And it turned out not to be a real bagel in the sense that to keep the sort of jurisdictions straight on the bakers' unions, the people who had pumpernickel bagels were then, at the beginning, of course, just one flavor. They didn't have soy waste bagels or blueberry bagels or anything. But sometimes if pumpernickel people had extra dough, they made bagels out of them or they put them in a bagel shake. But to keep them from being a bagel and getting into the jurisdiction of the other union, they didn't boil them. And there's an intermediate process with a bagel that you have to boil it first. So technically what we were looking for was not a real bagel. And I couldn't find it anyway.
It was tasty. You remember very well.
It was fabulous. Fabulous.
After all these years of the New Yorker, I'm sure you've got lots of stories. What was it like when You work for the legendary editors, I'm guessing.
Not Ross. Okay. I was in high school when Ross died. But
You work with Sean?
Sean, okay. Yeah. For most of the time I was at the New Yorker, Sean was the editor, yeah.
I hear he was quite a character.
He was an unusual man. There's no question about that. Quite shy in a lot of ways. He called me Mr. Trillin. Uh-huh. From the start and to the finish, even though I was, I think, 27 when I got there. And I had come from Time where I was meant to call the managing editor by his first name, who was old enough to be my father. I couldn't quite bring myself to do it, but that's mm-hmm. what everybody did. So he was rather formal and rather shy. And I think his greatest talent, although he was a wonderful reader and he had a great eye, his greatest talent was he was a great listener. That he actually concentrated on what you were saying to him. And I think a lot of writers over the years came out of his office thinking at least one person understands what I'm trying to do. Uh-huh. And he also trusted his writers. You know, I mean, once he said, yeah, you're going to do that story, since he never went anywhere, he didn't go to parties or run around to airports or meet important people and all that. It was not interesting to him. You didn't define yourself contradicted by somebody he had just had cocktails with or something uh-huh. who actually didn't know anything about it but was a big shot of some sort. So that was very comforting. And he also didn't have any axe to grind. You know, he didn't have any reason to use anything you wrote for any other reason. He was a very comfortable person to work for.
Was he the one that had the secret family?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're told now by the secret family that he had a secret family. And yeah. I have no reason to doubt her. I mean, I don't know.
So he was very secretive.
Well, he was private. Uh-huh. And I think kind of secretive too. I mean, I think he had a sort of Jesuitical side He was very interested in for instance, you know, those departments at the New Yorker, like profiles and reporter at large and letters from something and all that, and our roving correspondence or whatever thing. He actually knew the difference between those, and I don't think anybody else ever did know the difference. He had a wonderful thing I used to call Mr. Sean's Witch, and that was that if you were referring not to the word that was next to the witch or the that, but a word farther back, what he called the remote antecedent, you used a witch instead of a that without a comma. So you'd say... say the wing of the bird which drooped a bit. Then the wing was drooping rather than the bird. But I always thought it was very interesting that he was the only one who knew about it. And so what good did it do exactly? Mm-hmm. But I didn't question that. And sometimes once I finally learned what it was, I used to sort of stick them in pieces just as a little greeting, like a smile face or something. Hi, Mr. Sean. Here I am.
You also had a brilliant, prolific writer who just kind of stopped writing, but he came to work every day and didn't really produce anything for many years until he passed away. You know what I'm talking
about? Joe Mitchell.
Yeah, Joe Mitchell.
Yeah, my hero. A wonderful man. Well, there were a lot of stories about why Mitchell quit writing. Mitchell had a piece in the New Yorker when I first got there around 1964. And then he died, I guess, seven years ago, or maybe longer than that now. So he was, I guess, in his late 50s maybe when he stopped writing. Or stopped publishing, I should say, because mm-hmm. he was still working on things. There were all sorts of tales to explain it, of course. I mean, some people said that Mitchell, who had started out as a split-page feature writer for an afternoon newspaper, meaning he wrote almost every day, There, one of the stories was that he had been riding at the same pace as everybody else. And then some English professor said that he was the greatest master of the English declarative sentence in the country, and that stopped him cold. I don't think that's true. And when I looked into it once, I found that he actually had gradually stopped. I mean, he just took longer and longer to get a piece done, and he was sort of a perfectionist. And I think that it's interesting that he quit writing, although to me the really amazing thing about Mitchell was not why he didn't write, but how he wrote what he did write, because he managed to get the marks of writing off of it, which is the most difficult trick, it seems to me. And it seemed almost to appear on the page without anybody having done anything to it. Wow. And he was able to write about people. You know, there's a little author's note in his second collection, his first New Yorker collection, which is called McSorley's Wonderful Saloon. And it says, and this was probably put out in the 40s or something, and it said, it's become fashionable to call the sort of people who are written about in this book the little people. So I abhor that term. They're as big as you are, whoever you are. And he really was able to say something like that because he faced people straight on. He never looked down at them condescendingly, or as that guy in the New Yorker anniversary cover every year sometimes seems to be doing with his monocle.
What do they call him?
Eustace Tilley is his name.
Okay. Well, it's really been a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Vic. It's been nice being here.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2003 interview with Calvin Trillin. And we've been going back into our Book Nook archive and pulling out interviews that haven't been heard on the station since they were originally recorded. And back in 2003, Calvin Trillin came through Yellow Springs. He was in Dayton that evening for a book signing for his book, Feeding a Yen. And it's a great book about food. He's written widely about food. He's also written about a lot of other things. And one of his books that I particularly liked was called American Fried. He's into fried food. He comes from the land of barbecue, Kansas City, Missouri. He was born there in 1935. He's now in his early 80s. His parents were Edith and Abe Trillin. And they called him Buddy. That was his boyhood nickname. He went to public schools in Kansas City and then on to Yale University. And he graduated in 1957 from Yale. He began his long association with the New Yorker magazine 6 years later in 1963, and he's still writing for them. As you might have heard in that interview, we talked about his former colleague Joseph Mitchell, who attained a certain degree of notoriety at the New Yorker. He had a long literary career. He wrote a number of books. He wrote a number of pieces in the New Yorker magazine. And then at one point, he just stopped producing anything. He would come into the office, and he would go into his little alcove, and he closed the door. And I think it was about 25 or 30 years, he didn't publish anything in the magazine. He didn't publish any books. And Calvin Trillin was asked in a recent interview who he admired as a writer. And Joseph Mitchell was the guy he admired. And I think it was for his writing that he did before he kind of disappeared. And Calvin Trillin has also written a lot about his personal life. After his wife died, he wrote a book about her called Alice, Let's Eat. And he's also even writing some crime fiction now and then. He was picked in the two-century retrospective of American True Crime by the Library of America for his story, Stranger with a Camera. Quite an interesting guy, a man of letters, Calvin Trillin. This has been the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. We have over 400 podcasts available. You can listen to anytime on the WYSO website, wyso.org.